Hey, welcome back to Edge. We have a fantastic Edge of Indy today. It's race time here in Indy with Memorial Day just around the turn. We're excited to talk about this season and talk to some cool players. I mean, racing and beer, right? They go together. We're talking to Daredevil Brewing Company, so this is going to be a fantastic show. I mean, just with the sheer fact that we have a brewer on deck here. We're also talking to IndyCar racer 2015 Indy Lights champion Spencer Pigot, all today on The Edge.
Your audio and video source featuring Indianapolis tech trends, marketing industry champions, and business innovation. This is Edge of Indy, broadcasting from Edge Media Studios. Let's get today's conversation started.
Okay, welcome back to Edge of Indy. If you have not come across Edge of Indy before, welcome to the show. Tell you a little bit about what we're doing here in Indianapolis. We're talking about everything local that goes on in Indianapolis. We're talking about marketing, new ideas, trends in technology, as well as innovators here in Indianapolis. And who's moving and shaking? What great business growth is happening in Indy? Creative agencies, charities as well. So we're trying to get a handle on what's happening here in Indy, and also invite you to choose local. That's the entire point of this show, is to be able to give some exposure to some local companies that are also looking to give back regularly to their community. So welcome back to Edge of Indy. That's what we're all about. So I'd like to introduce to you Michael Pearson, head brewer and co-founder of Daredevil Brewing. Michael, thanks for coming on the show today.
Well, it's good to see you. Thanks for having me.
You're more than welcome. More than welcome. Thank you for bringing the beer.
You're welcome. One thing a brewer can do is show up with beer.
Best this table has ever looked.
I'm saying.
Yeah. And also the most productive this table has ever been. Yeah.
Well, we've got a lot to even talk about and drink. And boy, Nate just
I knew you were going to say it, so I wanted to jump in ahead of time and make sure that
you have some sort of drinking game going on in your head that I don't know about.
Always.
It's like the word "the" or something.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's what happens when I show up to work.
Well, I mean, there's a few race day inspired local beers these days, right? And other than the race itself, what inspired you to make this beer, the Race Day Lager?
Well, Race Day Lager is a beer that, honestly, I brewed it originally to keep people from drinking my personal stash of German Pilsner. I was doing a lot of pilot brewing, and the thing with German lagers, particularly when you use traditional methods, they take longer to brew.
Okay.
And a lot of American brewing styles or British styles are things that you can turn around in 2 to 3 weeks in some cases. Whereas German techniques and ingredients really require more of a 6 to 8 week process. So I needed a way to fend off all the people that kept drinking my Kolsch and my Pilsner. And so I started messing around with what eventually became Race Day American Lager, which is unusual in its creation in that it's nearly an all malt craft lager. Mm-hmm. So it is a flavorful yet crisp, dry, refreshing interpretation of a style of beer that almost everybody thinks they know, and we wanted to put our twist on it and the higher quality techniques that are common to Daredevil Brewing.
Oh, fantastic. Well, tell us a little bit about the background of Daredevil Brewing, if you would.
Well, Daredevil is a production brewing facility in Speedway. Mm-hmm. That's where people know us now. We originally started in rural Shelby County, where myself, my twin brother, and my best friend Bill took a 3,000 square foot pole barn and turned it into our original production facility. We were all working full time and starting Daredevil. And from there, we launched the company with one beer, which was unheard of at the time. But that was Liftoff IPA,
okay,
which is what most people know us for. But as time goes on and we continue to grow, we're expanding into other types of beer that I enjoy brewing and that I have a lot of experience brewing. And that's where things like Race Day Lager and mm-hmm. other lagers that we're starting to brew and distribute are becoming more common and something that Daredevil's known for.
Well, you shared with me a bit of your background, your personal background and career, and give me the idea of it's fantastic that you're working with your family as well as your best friend. But give me an insight into the convergence of skills that you have that you brought to brewing.
For me, brewing is it's a direct extension of things I've always enjoyed doing. I've been somebody that likes to tinker. I grew up on a farm. That taught me hard work. That gave me a work ethic that I don't know I could have gotten anywhere else from my father and grandfather.
Sure.
And from there, I just learned to fix things and think about things. And you know, the nature of farming and the nature of brewing are very connected in that there's a seasonality to it. There's a connection to the raw materials that become mm-hmm. food, beverage, your life, basically, your sustenance. And that was a formative way to grow up. And I enjoyed school. Always enjoyed math and science. I knew I wanted to be an engineer when I was a very young child. And went to Purdue, learned a lot. Didn't learn enough to be an engineer, but learned enough to get a degree.
Okay, it happens to the best of us.
Well, but engineering and brewing are similar in that way too, in that you can't come out of school with enough to be good. You can come out of school with enough that somebody can identify you as trainable.
Right.
And I was fortunate to be able to go to work for a smaller American-owned controls company for the first 4 years of my career. Worked mm-hmm. with two really good mid-career engineers that taught me how to mentor, taught me how to really learn in the field. And
so you had a good foundation, mm-hmm. but that foundation is not nearly enough to make a career out of that. And you had some great mentors that gave you that type of additional work ethic guidance as yes. well?
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And it was about 15 years into my engineering career that I started to really get serious about brewing as a possible future. And honestly, it was out of boredom. I was working for a large pharmaceutical company here in Indianapolis. I had moved back to Indy in 2002. Mm-hmm. I'd been a consulting engineer for a number of years and was traveling a lot, and just was at a point in my life I wanted something else. And Indianapolis was starting to become the Indy that we all know now. It just was a little bit different.
Yeah.
But you could see the foundation. I'd lived in Denver and Kansas City and seen similar transformations in their infancy. And I was excited about coming back to Indy and being part of what I thought would be a similar, I don't want to say resurrection of the downtown, but, you know, transformation.
Pretty darn close.
So I think I got back here at a good time.
Yeah.
And so the pace of my work was slower than I was used to. So I started homebrewing to continue to really stay interested in things like fermentation science mm-hmm. and there's other parts of brewing that are technical from a lab perspective. Mm-hmm. It was just a way for me to occupy my intellectual interests.
Well, if you're going to have a hobby, it might as well be brewing, right?
It might as well.
I homebrew. I can back that up.
And from there, things sort of just rolled from there. I became pretty good at home brewing. I had professional brewers seeking me out for advice.
Cool.
I was doing just pro bono consulting for recipe creation, sensory evaluation, just engineering stuff.
Yep.
Whether it be process or instruments or equipment related. And in 2008 and 11, I was the Indiana Home Brewer of the Year.
Oh, wow.
It's kind of fun to think about because that was a long time ago.
Yeah. Caleb, does that make you feel inadequate?
Absolutely.
Good. Yeah. I just wanted to make sure.
He counters with his beard.
Yeah. Yeah. But for me, I got into beer judging, and those competitions weren't about winning things. They were more about getting blind feedback.
Yeah. Huh.
And
almost like a focus group right there kind of thing.
Yeah. It's like a free focus group. Almost.
There you go.
Yeah.
And you're making people happy. That's awesome, and that's a great story. Just be mindful of. You can certainly turn hobbies into a lucrative career, right?
I don't know about
lucrative. Well, yeah, I mean, you're getting compensated in one way, shape, or form. You're bringing happiness to the masses.
It's rewarding.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
What I tell people is that brewing is a lifestyle choice. It's not the type of career, regardless of the one-off headlines where people are getting paid out.
Right.
Those are really unusual and special circumstances. Most people who brew beer or prepare food for a living do it out of love.
Absolutely. In my previous lives, I've been a bartender and a waiter in different food and beverage. And I mean, the people that actually have the mom and pop restaurants, and we interviewed a bunch of them on the Yelp show, they love what they do.
Absolutely.
And with the amount of work and care that they put into it and the struggles that they have, right? You have to love it.
You have to.
So, I mean, this is in the same vein, is that it's a passion. It's an art form as well. And you've got to take it seriously, but you got to love what you're doing, right?
At the end of the day, you've got to be able to go home, get some sleep, and wake up the next morning and be just as excited as you were the day before.
But in the middle, you can actually drink what you've created.
That is true, yeah.
Usually it's at the end of the day, and that's why we call it a shift beer. Yeah.
Okay, so
but you get to decide when your own shifts are.
Okay, right? I think we're actually at the end of our shift right now, so we're going to crack open one of these guys. Okay,
you're behind.
I am behind. But I wanted to do it with Michael. You see, so
that's fine.
The Race Day Lager. Okay, how's this moving? From just production, the production facility in Shelbyville, to having a tap room in Speedway. I mean, that was a big jump.
It was a very big jump. And for us, it's always humbling to talk about the Speedway experience because of all the things that we went through before we chose Speedway.
Oh, that's really good.
And sometimes you just talk about, like, there's synergies that fall into your lap. And, mm-hmm. you know, you've got this branding that looks like it was made for Speedway and our corporate logo and a lot of our branding.
Yeah.
But the end result is just we get an opportunity to be part of something that's bigger than us. And that's really what I think about every time I think about, you know, we're in Speedway. As far as the beer goes, mm-hmm. Race Day is, it's really two things. We talked a little bit about why.
Yep.
But one of the fun parts about this beer is it also allowed me to come up with a nice link with one of our local restaurants, the Tamale Place. Mm. So the Tamale Place processes a lot of corn. And as you can imagine, those half-pound tamales go through many, many, many 50-pound bags of corn. And they make their own masa. And
oh, my Lord.
The little hint of corn that's in this beer comes from the Tamale Place. So I work with them to get several hundred pounds of masa that we turn into a slurry. And through all the times when I was testing this recipe, the one thing that I learned was people don't necessarily want to taste corn, but if there wasn't this hint of it, it's just like your mind didn't engage and you weren't thinking about all these memories, positive memories that you'd had about drinking some type of American lager.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was amazing to me how there's this little, I mean, 0.5% of corn in the recipe, but without it, it's just people don't engage the beer quite the same.
I am very appreciative of you sitting on the stage there because I can taste it. I don't know if my mind's diving into it. I can really taste that. So what the motivation of choosing Speedway for the tap room? Obviously, there's a great a growth in Speedway and there's a resurgence of the racing community and the entire community. By and large there. So what was the direct motivation of getting out there as opposed to different areas of growth here in the city?
Well, when we looked at sites and we went through about a 9-month process to try to find the future home of Daredevil Brewing. And the thing that we originally were hoping to do was to find a way to purchase the Allison One building, which is roughly 1200 Main Street. It's a wonderful structure. But it's not for sale. But it's one of those things where we at least attempted to contact the owner and see if there was a way we could acquire part of it or lease it. And because there's a lot of history with breweries renovating buildings in cities or towns that are looking to bring new growth opportunities. Because in the case of a destination brewery, it becomes quite, you know, it becomes a tourist attraction, becomes a reason for people to visit.
Yep.
After that initial investigation, we became aware of a large 22-acre part of the east side of Main Street that was going to basically go up for sale. Speedway Redevelopment Commission had put a lot of effort into this former GM facility. It had been cleared. The land had been cleaned up.
Oh, well, right on Main Street.
Right on Main Street. That's basically awesome. Between Dalera and 10th Street.
Yeah, we all went there last year.
That was all we did.
Without you.
Open. And the they had initially tried to bid it to a single developer. They weren't able to fulfill the sale that way.
Right.
So there was a plan to break up and sell parcels. And that's when we got our introduction to the Speedway Redevelopment Commission. And it became quite obvious to both sides very quickly that we had similar goals. Mm-hmm. They were looking to transform Main Street. We were looking to be part of a community that we could be an anchor in and help with those types of transformations.
Oh, very cool.
And we very quickly worked out the details of a development agreement and waited months for the lawyers to dot the I's and cross the T's as they need to. And about 8 months later, began construction on what is now Daredevil Brewing Company in Speedway.
Very cool.
So I have a question for you that just out of curiosity, you know, we talked a little bit earlier about off camera about, you know, the competitiveness in the space now and the number of craft breweries that are coming out. So in the space that we tend to work here at Site Strategics, you know, obviously we do marketing to try and help people gain a competitive advantage and things of that nature. Within the brewing community, what are some of the differentiators that would give Daredevil or anybody else a competitive advantage over a neighbor or some other of these craft breweries that are coming up around town, and, you know, especially within Indianapolis? I mean, we've got a dozen, two dozen craft breweries that are around now that people can get to. So what gives you guys, or what could potentially give you guys or somebody else that's thinking about starting a brewery, that competitive advantage and that competitive edge?
Well, I think with anything that's a product that's being being created, first off is I think you actually better be good at brewing. And let's assume that you've got the ability to make really good beer. The next thing is about 90% of success is going to come from whether or not you can run a business, that you can put together a solid plan. And one of the most challenging things is if you decide to run a brew pub or a tap room, that's a very different business model than saying, I'd like to be, you know, one of the larger production breweries and ship beer. Shipping beer, you know, an analogy that I'll use is brewing beer that you're going to sell in a growler, and basically all the beer's gone in 30 days or less. You know, that's basically like a tricycle. Brewing beer, putting it in a can or keg, shipping it to market all over your own state. Now we're getting a lot closer to like an IndyCar. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot that could go wrong. and you've got to be able to have very good control of your entire process, every process step. The beer could be great, but if you don't package it correctly, it's not going to make your consumer happy. You're going to have, you're just not going to have repeat customers. So you always got to come to the table with the idea of, I've got one chance at convincing somebody that they should take a second drink. I mean, if they're not going to take a second drink, they're certainly not going to open a second can.
You wouldn't have that problem with Nate or myself for that matter.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know,
let's just get this out of the way then.
To your point, I mean, we're at a time and a place where consumers are, you know, much more discerning.
Absolutely.
With their palates. And so, like you said, I mean, the product has to be good, or I mean, you're destined to fail. And yeah. And even, you know, also off camera, we were kind of talking about your branding too. And this is a consumer's assumption, but, you know, maybe you could add a little bit to that. But I feel like with you know, the competitive nature of the industry right now, it's important to have, you know, really solid branding because of that limited shelf space that, mm-hmm. you know, you're looking at, because there are only so many shelves in stores. But as breweries grow, I mean, you know, how do you get in there and how do you advertise your product?
No, I agree. Branding's extremely important. So we'll kind of get a list going here. Make good beer.
Right.
Understand that you have to be able to run a business as effectively as you need to be able to brew good beer. You need branding. And not only does branding, I think, become so important because it's a visual connection. There's people buy differently. Some people buy purely on visuals. Some people want information. So the language that you use on your in your branding or on your products really matters.
Yeah.
And I always look at it as there's a bunch of great branding and marketing books out there. And I always fall into this kind of simple discussion of what we're trying to do is to market to our tribe. They're all out there. Mm-hmm. And if we understand what it is we're making and why we're making it. So I think the story behind the beer matters too. And the better our branding communicates who we are and why we matter, the easier it is for our tribe to find our beer. And we don't have to be everybody's favorite beer. We certainly aren't going to make every kind of beer out
sure.
there.
Yeah.
But what I'm going to do is make sure that the beers we put in front of people have a story and that they matter.
But I will give you props on, you know, you have done a lot of different styles, and I mean, I've had most of them, you know.
Now I feel way less bad about Aaron's comment.
You know, but Liftoff is, you know, one of, if not the best local IPAs. I love JWP, your stout. Carnival is a fantastic saison,
and it's one of the most recognizable too. You guys have done.
Is the stout here?
I did not bring any of the stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, just like the branding and that visual is one of the things that sticks into my head whenever I think of Daredevil is of the Liftoff IPA too.
Yeah,
and that's one of those, you know, every beer's got a story behind it. And for me, Liftoff, you know, it's our first beer. And we get asked questions all the time about like, how do you name the company or why did you do this? And then, of course, names. How did you come up with that name? Well, naming stuff's hard these days
because
there's a lot of people naming beers, and we went through a lot of different lists, and we talked about you know, what does Daredevil mean. And my whole thing with the first beer was I wanted the name to be action oriented, and I wanted it to somehow convey all of the challenges of opening a brewery. And when I was working through these endless lists trying to come up with something that we could use because it hadn't been used by anybody else, eventually it got into just rocketeering. And it's not really a big stretch. You start to go, okay, I'm doing my countdown. I'm literally looking at like the NASA list of, you know, how does this go down and what are the different words that are used. And I remember getting to ignition, and that one was used by somebody.
But it's R. Kelly, actually. But
and then I thought, well, Liftoff. Well, that's interesting. Because one of the things about starting a new business is everybody thinks about the ignition moment as, oh, you opened. But
right.
the ignition happened way down the line. And what they're really seeing is the first visible sign of the energy the partners put into the business. So Liftoff seemed like a pretty good name to connect to our passion.
Yeah, yeah.
And
you know, we're bonding right now with all of this. The Site Strategics logo is a rocket. We've named a lot of our marketing tiers and platforms and stuff off of.
Don't steal my name.
Well, I feel like we have something here that
we
need to be
for
together.
The official beer sponsor. Of Site Strategics.
Yeah, seems like a natural.
And I also at the tap room, I love the Liftoff guy. And does the Liftoff guy have a name?
Well, he's Flying Man.
Oh,
so
okay.
That's based on the Da Vinci artwork.
Yes.
Okay. Yep,
it's originated absolutely. From.
So I love the Flying Man that's hanging from the ceiling in the tap room. That is so cool.
Yeah, that one. That's my brother's thing.
Yeah.
So he does these little marketing projects. And as it turns out, our branding company, which is a cultivator out of Denver, Colorado, they do a lot of work for a company that builds all kinds of stuff for Lucasfilms. Mm. And they were in once and saw all of our branding and said, we love this. Who are these guys? And as it turned out, they had this project to make the Flying Man. And they were like, we'll do it for whatever budget they have. We don't care.
Right. Yeah.
Otherwise, there's no way.
But that Cultivator doesn't have a rocket ship for a logo, though.
Yeah, that's true.
No, you know? They don't.
I'm just saying. So as we're live, we certainly want to ask for any comments or questions at the live feed. So we'll be able to put the comments up on the screen. So feel free to ask some questions of Michael, as well as Nate or Caleb here.
But don't ask questions to Aaron.
No, I'll field no questions.
Nope.
So Michael, you're hosting the Hops and Flip Flops Festival again this year. Can you tell us about that and some other festivals that you're attending?
Well, for us, the Hops and Flip Flops is our primary philanthropic event. It's not just a festival. What we've used Hops and Flip Flops for is a way to bring awareness to Speedway Trails. Mm-hmm. And that's the primary benefactor of the festival. So what we're working with Speedway Trails to do is to really just revitalize their trail system. Mm-hmm. And eventually connect it to the White River Trail system and make it a more integrated part of Indianapolis.
Oh, cool.
A lot of people forget that Speedway is only about 4 miles from downtown. Mm-hmm. But just due to the nature of the streets between there and here,
right,
biking or bike access to downtown from Speedway is more limited than we think it should be.
Yep.
And a lot of people in Speedway would like to bike back and forth to downtown too.
No, that'd be awesome, yeah.
And actually, you know, on the topic of biking, I saw that, you know, again this year you're doing the Bike to the 500, or you're hosting that. How many years has that been going on, and have you seen some good growth of that?
Well,
I think it's a great idea. It's, you know, it's one, a safe way to get in and out, and efficient way, because I've been in the traffic trying to get to the race on race day.
It's IndyCog does a lot of the real footwork behind it. We provide them a space to park all those bikes. Last year was the first year because it was the first year that we were open for the race. This year, from what I've seen, it looks like it's growing a lot. I don't have a final number projected for that, but we definitely saw a lot of people enjoy that opportunity to bike to the race and back. And we're looking for that event to grow over time.
Oh, very good. Well, pardon me. Well, aside from your own tap room and beers, what are some other favorite spots that you actually may have around Indy? Because you're certainly plugged in, and you're certainly focusing on Indianapolis growth. This, you know, with your partnership with Speedway, I mean, there's got to be some like-minded individuals such as yourself that you've come to know that are business owners around town. Give a spotlight on some of these that are out there, maybe even some favorite local breweries that you have.
Oh, man. So I lived in downtown Indy for a number of years. I just moved to Speedway because it was easier for me. So I live about 4 blocks from the brewery now. But when I lived
a hell
downtown,
of a commute that is.
Yeah. I think we call that stumbling distance. That's what we call that.
Depends how many shift beers you have, I guess.
One shift a day, no matter how long it is.
Yep.
Only one shift.
Yeah.
But when I lived downtown, I lived near Mass Ave, so I always found it interesting the places people talked about who weren't from that area.
Right.
And it's changed a lot. I mean, there's so many more great restaurants to go to, you know, but some of the locals are still great locals, whether they be like the Mass Ave pub, for example.
Sure.
Which a lot of people go to. But I remember when, one of the places that opened that really started to change Mass Ave, I thought at the time, was Black Market. At the very end, there was nothing down there. It's like, how is that place going to survive? Well, they made really great food. That's how. And I think the team at Black Market really started some great things. And, you know, since then, they've opened other places. It's the same ownership. Mm-hmm. Places like, well, Siam Square was first, I believe, before mm-hmm. Black Market, but I don't remember exactly. But they also own Rook. So there's some really good places that they've opened. And I just think that anymore, I'll be honest. I mean, I'm just as happy getting a Shapiro's sandwich as anything else in the downtown. Yeah. That's probably my...
They got the meats, don't they?
Yeah.
Oh, my Lord.
I'm a big fan. If I could only eat at one place, it might be Shapiro's. I barbecue a lot, so I have a lot of respect for their really homemade, amazing deli quality.
I've not had their brisket yet. I got to check that out. But their Reuben is fantastic. Their corned beef.
Corned beef, yep.
Is out of this world.
Corned beef, pastrami.
Yep, absolutely. So, I mean, kind of pulling it back around, back to Speedway, because I really think there's a big opportunity to be able to do some outreach to Speedway. And then obviously this is the race and we want to give some focus and some props to what the Speedway revitalization group is doing out there. What else are they doing with different organizations out there to be able to help the growth in Speedway?
Well, I'm the brewer, not the marketing guy. So my twin brother would have really good answers for some of these questions.
Well, but if your twin brother's watching, he needs a comment on the
feed.
Yeah,
he should get on the feed and he can chime in. But, what I see as a business owner is that Speedway and the Redevelopment Commission continue to invest in infrastructure that makes being a business there easier. Mm-hmm. They do a lot to promote beyond just the race. So, you know, when I think about the Speedway that I know today versus 5 years ago or 10 years ago, what I've seen them do is bring in a lot of new businesses. When we opened the brewery, there were 3 restaurants on Main Street. There are 8 now, with more coming. There's a mixed retail hotel apartment complex that's going to be built on the corner next to the roundabout. There's been a lot of revitalization and construction on the exit at Crawfordsville Road and 465. So you can see them engaging in different ways at the very local level, Main Street, and then at the corridor level, at the highway. And they're putting a lot more focus on Crawfordsville Road as Main Street has kind of gotten enough inertia that it's going in a direction that seems to be stable at this point. And then I think once we get full connection of the trail system, which actually the trailhead's at our brewery, so that's one... just another kind of piece of synergy that like we're at the beginning and ending of the trailhead.
That's awesome, actually. Get at the end of that trail and there's Daredevil right there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We just need a rainbow over the top.
Well, that's fantastic. You got to give a shout out to them. Michael, to wrap up, are there any words of wisdom, for lack of a better expression, that you would give craft brewers that are trying to break through? And I mean, it's from hobby, and I mean, it starts with passion. There's obviously the hobbyists, and there's that next level, right, where they're trying to break through and actually create that business. And there's a lot of strugglers that are trying to do what you've done, you know, let alone just keep a business going, but be able to get it to market. What would you give them as a word of advice of how to do it or what to avoid?
Well, I think the big thing is to try and do everything you can to get experience. The more experience, the better. Before you really think about I'm going to start a brewery, think about all the steps to become what part of that brewery you intend to be. Are you going to be the brewer at that brewery? Are you going to be the manager of the brewery? What's your part of it? Once you figure out what your part is, I would say do everything you can to become the expert at that part, and then surround yourself with people who can fill in the other pieces. But the more experience that you can get, the better, whether it be through formal, I would always say formal education and hands-on have to be parts of your repertoire. You can't theoretically make beer. And it's really hard to brew beer without a technical background so that you can understand what the goal is. I mean, if you can't see the dartboard you're about to throw a dart at,
you could get lucky.
You could get lucky, but can you repeat it? That's what you see a lot of times is the grind of this business is that you are expected to be perfect. And you need to have that mindset of there is no compromise. There's no, it was almost a good batch.
Right.
And that takes a lot of preparation up front to execute on a regular basis.
All right, a bonus question. Whenever you're dealing, I mean,
is it from Caleb?
No.
Oh.
But I'm channeling Caleb here.
Oh, okay.
Because there's a
I know him.
There's a he's actually right here, so that's kind of weird.
Yeah, I don't know. Do whatever you got to do.
The consumer is very what do I want to say oriented towards craft beer now, and their tastes are certainly differentiated by all the different stratification of beer that's out there, and the brewers that are out there. What type of engagement do you have with those consumers? I heard Seth Godin whenever you were talking tribes here for a second,
yeah.
but whenever it comes down to connection to the consumers, because there's so many brands out there, right? And and it's just a saturation. That brand loyalty is something that you obviously understand. So does your brother. Be able to connect to your consumers and be able to champion them, right? What do you do to help engage with your consumers and your brand loyalists to really be able to get feedback and on top of that, get them to champion you?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one of the things that we've always had a focus on is social media. Mm-hmm. It is the easiest way in the modern era to communicate quickly with people and get feedback.
Mm-hmm.
So Shane does a great job with all of our social media feeds are very interactive. His background is software, and he's got a lot more marketing experience than I have. And I think that this is part of that. Know what part of the brewery you're going to be an expert in.
Absolutely.
He's taking care of that part really well. So I think that it's not enough to brew beer that people want to drink. That's what we'd all like to do. But at the end of the day, this is a business that requires people to spend money on beer, and you'd like them to buy beer. We'd right. like them to come out to our tap room. We want them to come out and spend time with us.
Yep.
I spend a lot of time in the tap room talking with guests, educating them about beer, talking to them about why our beers taste the way they do, why they smell the way they do. Hmm. German beer in particular has a very distinctive set of sensory characteristics. And if you spend time with Germans, and I have a lot of German heritage, I have German family, they almost always start by smelling their beer before they drink it. And that's just one of those things. But I really like the opportunity to have consistency across what's it like to be at Daredevil Brewery, what's it like to buy Daredevil Brewery, what's it like to interact with Daredevil Brewery in social media. And we should always be giving a consistent, high quality experience to everybody. And, you know, our tagline is aggressively fun. So, you know, at the end of the day, we really want to be part of people's best moments. Some of the best moments we all can talk about in our lives, there may have been a beer involved in it or a beverage of some type. And we would just like to be in their mind when they're thinking about that beer they're going to pair with one of their favorite moments.
Like the race.
Perfect.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Like a great race day.
Like a great race day. Where can people get race day? Can they just get it at your regular old liquor store around Indy, or you know, do you have a specific distributor or provider, you know, Crown or Payless or anybody like that?
Race Day.
Or only at Daredevil?
No, Race Day Craft Lagers, for the first time, was distributed throughout Indiana.
Awesome.
So we began distribution in mid-April to all major package stores. Some groceries are carrying it, although that wasn't a focus this year. We're distributed by Monarch World Class Beer in central and southern Indiana, and Indiana Beverage in northern Indiana. It should be hard not to find Race Day Lager at any major package store and some grocery.
Yeah, I mean, all things considered, you better have a race day in your hands on race day, yeah. right?
And you can always come to the brewery.
That is true.
We sell cans, growlers, and crawlers.
Getting a road trip thought here?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, check
right
out.
Now, right now?
Like, right now. Okay. We're going home with you, Michael.
Yep.
So check out all of the products. And quickly, Michael, just give us a showcase of these products and their flavors. What we got here?
Well, we've got Liftoff IPA, which is our flagship
yep.
and the beer most people know us for. Our Vacation Kolsch, which is our GABF Silver Metal Kolsch. Mm-hmm. It's probably the beer that we sell second most right now. And also just one, we've distributed it long enough. A lot of people know us for that beer.
Cool.
We've got the Race Day Lager that we've been speaking about quite a bit. And then this year marks the first year that we're distributing lager beer throughout Indiana. And the next beer that we'll begin distribution of in June is our German-style Pilsner, which is the blue can on the left.
Oh, boy. Well, we're going to have to do some samplings here after the show here. I'm just warning everybody.
Sweet. I'm in.
Yep.
All right. So you can reach Daredevil at their social media spaces on Twitter, at Daredevil Beer, Facebook, Facebook.com, obviously, Daredevil Beer, Instagram, Daredevil Beer. I'm tripping over that. Daredevil got me here. and the website, daredevilbeer.com. That's fantastic that you were able to pick them all up with that. As opposed to having to hyphenate anything. So fantastic. Reach out to them socially. This is a brand, guys, that is fantastic for their social media connections, and they truly do get the consumer connection and the tribal side of this, right? Because that's what you're talking about whenever you're talking about craft beers is finding your tribe and be able to listen as well as let them know what's going on, right?
Find those beer nerds.
Find those beer nerds. All right. Michael, any final words for you?
Oh, I just want to thank you for having me on.
Oh, you're more than welcome.
Hope Thanks you guys get a chance to enjoy some track time here in the next week.
I don't know if we'll probably stop by Daredevil and just stay there.
That might be true.
Please do.
Yep.
All right. Coming up, we're going to be talking to Spencer Pigott, IndyCar driver extraordinaire. He's jumping into the car for the second time. First time was last year. This time he's going after it again. What a fantastic guy. And we're talking to him. We're coming up right after this.
This is Edge of Indy, showcasing Indianapolis tech trends, marketing industry champions, and business innovation. Broadcasting from Edge Media Studios. Now, let's get back to today's topic.
Okay, hey, welcome back. I'd like you to meet someone really special and plugged into the race scene. Meet Spencer Pigott, IndyCar driver for Ed Carpenter Racing and Yunkus Racing. Spencer, thanks so much for joining us on the show today.
Hey, no problem. Thanks for having me.
You're more than welcome. Hey, Spencer Pigott qualified on for the 101st running of the Indianapolis 500 this weekend, and he'll be starting 29th in car number 11 with Yunkus Racing. Now, so tell us how you joined up with Yunkus.
Yeah, it's been it was a good story. I mean, Yunkus Racing, this is their first ever IndyCar race, so it's a very unique experience for them. But the deal with them kind of came together really quick. You know, pretty much the beginning of May is when it was all finalized, and usually that's not how it happens. You know, you want to have a lot of time to kind of prepare for the race, which they've had on the cars, but for me to start working with them, it all kind of happened pretty late, and especially as I was racing for Ed Carpenter on the Grand Prix
right.
Here in Indy. So, trying to toss two teams around sure. and focus on everything because they're both extremely important races. So it's been a lot going on, but my relationship with Yunkus Racing actually dates back all the way to the very beginning of my racing career back when I was 10, 11 years old racing for them in go-karts and all around Florida.
So you've known them that long. That's fantastic, and they've seen you move through your career. And are most of the same people still with Yunkus?
There's quite a few. Yeah, I mean it's a real family team. It's Ricardo Yunkus, his wife Danielle, and his brother Ale, who have been there from the start. And Ricardo came over from Argentina with literally nothing, and he raced back in Argentina and realized that it wasn't going to come together for him to be a professional driver with the goal, like we all have, of being an IndyCar or Formula One. So came to America, he started working on go-karts and started his own go-kart team in Miami. And I'm from Orlando, so but most of the karting in Florida was happening down south. So we'd always be driving down to Miami to go racing, and got hooked up with Ricardo and drove for him. I was about 10 to 12 years old and won a lot of races, a lot of national championships together. And then our paths kind of separated a little bit as I went into car racing through the junior formula, Skip Barber, USF 2000, and his path led him to car racing as well. He began a Pro Mazda team, which is the kind of the second level of the ladder system called the Mazda Road to Indy that leads the IndyCar. So he was doing that. I was doing USF 2000. And when I was able to jump up to Pro Mazda my second year in that championship, we joined forces again. And it was like nothing had ever changed. I mean, we won right away. We won that Pro Mazda championship in 2014. Next year, moved up to Indy Lights as rookies. We won that championship. And now here we are at the Indy 500. So it's been a really cool thing to watch their progression, and you know, to be a part of it in different levels has been really special.
Absolutely. So you've been able to go on the same tracks. So there
there we go. Starting already.
All right. That's a really cool story. And on top of that, I mean, that's almost an American dream, right? And it is. Mm-hmm. I mean, be able to come into this country and be able to, with nothing, and be able to go all the way through the professional driving circuit. Now, you've got a great story as well. So you're from Orlando. When did you first become interested in racing?
Well, I first became interested in racing forever. I mean, my dad used to race, so he was always into it, and always every weekend watching IndyCar, Formula One, sports cars, you know, motocross. I actually started racing dirt bikes first when I was about 5 years old, and then raced bicycles, BMX bikes, and then finally got a go-kart when I was about eight. So, you know, racing's always been a part of my life, and I've just loved it ever since. You know, I played other sports. You know, soccer is my other favorite sport, but still, you know, nothing really compares to racing and the speed and the adrenaline you get.
Yep.
You know, starting a race, even go-karting, you know, even though you're maybe only going 70 miles an hour, still, you know, there's 30, 40 go-karts all trying to win the race, and it's no different now. We're just going a little bit faster.
Okay, hold on a second, Spencer. I'm literally hearing your entire life here, and I've got four kids, and the youngest is 6 years old. If I actually put him on a dirt bike right now, oh my gosh, well, he'd probably tear it up. But my 17-year-old doesn't even want to drive right now. By the time you were 17, what were you racing?
17. I was racing USF 2000.
And how fast were you going?
About 130 or so. So, but you know, it's all relative, right? I mean, there's guys that I watch that I think are absolutely nuts. You know, these motocross riders and MotoGP. Mm-hmm. And I think those guys are crazy, and, you know, they think the same of us, but we don't really think anything of it. So it's just, wow. I guess it's all kind of what you're
so
used
to. So do you
have
to have a driver's license to get into the Mazda series, or do they, can they be a 15, 14-year-old?
Oh, yeah, there's kids in there that are 14 years old racing USF 2000, and, yeah, there's no...
So do they have
They go through a licensing test system. Okay. Yeah, I mean, they don't have a written test, or they don't necessarily be observed at a controlled environment. Basically, you kind of submit your resume, submit what you've done, karting, you know, whatever formula car racing you've done, and it goes off to the FIA, which is the global governing body, basically, of motorsports, and they can either approve or deny you. Pretty much everyone gets approved. I mean, there's some guys out there that, you know, might not...
are completely crazy.
Exactly. So,
and for the
for
good
lack
of the cause.
Better words, it's pretty lax.
Well, that's amazing. I mean, and we're certainly familiar with we've had a strong relationship with Sarah Fisher Racing for a while, and we tracked her career for a long time in karting and go karts. It's just amazing seeing youth grow up in that sport, because the dexterity and the focus and the attention, and I mean, there's so many things that they have to pay attention to at that young age. It's just amazing.
Yeah, it is. It's a very unique sport, and in a lot of ways, but in some ways, you know, people don't realize it's just like every other sport. You know, you start playing basketball or soccer or whatever when you're young, and you know, you play through your whole life to try and be good enough to be a professional. So it's the same in racing. You know, you start racing go-karts, some people at 4 or 5 years old, and they're called kid karts. They're tiny little things that go maybe 45, 50 miles an hour, and these kids, you know, it looks like they're playing the peewee football with the helmets twice as big as their body. So, you know, same thing. You grow up with it, you start racing, you gradually get into bigger and faster go-karts, and then you have to kind of start all over again once you get to the age of moving into car racing. And they just get bigger and faster and more competition, and just like the NFL or anything else. So in many ways it's unique because it's not just you and your teammates playing. There's all these different circumstances and all these different things that can happen,
right.
You know, with this mechanical machine, you know, things can break that are out of your control and that can kind of ruin everything. So it's, you know, it's what makes it so interesting.
But that's really important is your relationship to the team that works on that car. And I'm very well aware that there's a huge bond that happens with the racing teams is that, I mean, let alone the fact that they're double checking everything, but you've got to trust every mechanic that's behind that because, I mean, if you're going as fast as you're going, right, 222, 228 miles an hour, right, it's
yeah.
a huge factor, and you've got to have, I mean, you're giving your trust completely to that team that's got your back there, right?
Yeah, you are. I mean, they're obviously doing their best, but, yeah. you know, mistakes do happen, and you just have to trust that they're doing everything they can to make sure that the car is perfect. You know, going yeah. those speeds, everything has to be. Everything's yeah. got to be looked over twice. Everything's got to be tight. Everything's got to be lubricated that needs lubrication. And, you know, it's very important to have good guys, which I've been lucky to have pretty much my whole career. I've always had really good mechanics. And, you know, that's the people that are in control of you, basically. Mm-hmm. I mean, they look over everything, they make sure everything's right, and if it's not, they, you know, they'll stay up all night. I mean, after the crash we had on Friday, the guys are literally there all night repairing the car to have it back in time to qualify on Saturday. So they literally want to win as bad as we do.
Absolutely.
They're super competitive. They work way too hard for the amount of recognition and appreciation they get. It's, you know, it's amazing what these guys do for racing, because they're all racers, right? They all yeah. love it, and it's their way of being involved.
Oh, very cool. And that's right, you did have a crash on Friday, and we talked about it before the show, and it was just, you're going pretty darn fast, 222 miles an hour, and you're able, it got away from you, right?
Yeah, so basically what happened is, you know, we're getting ready for qualifying.
Right.
It was on Friday, Fast Friday, where we get extra horsepower, so for Friday, Saturday, Sunday of the Indy 500, getting ready for qualifying, you get extra horsepower to go faster for qualifying speed, you know, kind of increase the show,
yeah.
increase mm-hmm. the excitement. And, you know, we were really actually wasn't even going for a fast lap. You know, 222 is not very fast, really, when you're getting ready for qualifying. We'd been doing
right.
227s or so, and we went out on old tires with little downforce because the way you get speed out of the car is you take the downforce away. So you make the wings less efficient, basically. So you go through the air faster, but there's less force pushing you into the road,
right,
so
right,
you have less
right.
grip.
Right.
And we just kind of underestimated the lack of grip in the old tires, and that was enough to just cross that super fine line of being in control and being out of control. So, you know, literally it spun before I even knew what was happening, and it was really unfortunate because the guys, like I said, had to spend a lot of time getting the car fixed. And
yeah.
this whole Indy 500 is basically a carbon copy of my last one so far, because last year, my rookie year, I had a flat tire going into turn one, spun and crashed, and I qualified in exactly the same spot this year as I did last year. So unfortunately, everything's going the same.
Oh my gosh.
So hopefully the race goes better, but
so when you know when you're getting an accident, what do you do as a driver? Do you
right.
just brace for impact and just let it happen, or do you try to steer it so you hit it? You were talking about before about it was just the angle that Sebastian Bourdais hit the wall that got him injured for the race. What do you do as a driver to hope?
Right.
Do you tighten up or do you go loose?
Well, you know, at Indy, there's not much time to do anything,
yeah.
honestly. I mean, you're going so fast, and the track's fairly narrow. So by the time you realize you're backwards within, you know, thousandths of a second almost, you're splattering against the wall. So it's very difficult to brace or to kind of do anything to prevent the accident.
Okay.
Because if you get even slightly out of control, there's no room for error.
Right.
I mean, you're going to crash. So it's just, you know, in Sebastian's case, he was doing everything he could to save the slide, and it hooked him back into the wall at a really bad angle, which is a real shame because he was flying. I mean, he was probably going to be on pole this weekend, but,
oh, wow.
No, that's what it is. I mean, it's just you're flirting with that fine line of of brilliance and, you know, just excitement and being able to put it all together and crashing the car. So basically the only thing you can do is hopefully let go of the steering wheel, because that's where a lot of little injuries come from, is the wheel gets whipped out of your hands when your front wheels hit the wall or hit something. So that's basically all you can do is get your hands off the wheel and just relax if you can. I mean, the more tense you are, the more likely you are to get injured. But just try and get your hands off the wheel and hope it doesn't hurt too bad.
Oh, man. I know from, I took one semester of karate in college, but like when you get punched, you tighten up your gut. Yeah.
Right.
So I wasn't sure if it was like something like that you tightened up to help.
For sure, you probably do a little bit. It's, there's not much space to move, which is the idea. You know, your head's very locked in with all this special padding and foam around your head to kind of absorb any impact. And the seat takes 2 days to make these seats because they're all custom formed to our body. It's this kind of beaded foam, and it hardens as you sit in. You have to sit in the car for, you know, an hour or 2 hours to make sure it forms and molds just to your body. So there's no room to move in there. And we've got a Hans device, which kind of prevents the head from going forward too much. And IndyCar has done a great job making the cars as safe as possible.
Yeah, those pods around you. I mean, the pocket you're in is layers upon layers of give that will break away before it actually gets in and harms you, right?
Yeah, the more parts that are flying off the car, as crazy as it sounds, is the better, because that absorbs a lot of the energy and absorbs the impact. So it looks a bit more spectacular, but it's actually kind of better for the driver, because that's kind of taking the force away from his body and putting it on the car.
Yep. Well, for listeners who don't know, and we covered it earlier, Spencer was the 2014 Pro Mazda champion and the 2015 Indy Lights champion, and that earned him a spot in the 100th running of the Indy 500. That's last year's race. So what was it like to get into that car for the first time at IMS?
Oh, it was amazing. I mean, this is the dream. This is what I've wanted to do forever, and you know, everyone racing go-karts from the age of 8 or 9 years old wants to be in the Indy 500, so for it all to come together was, you know, something that obviously we'd always hoped for, but, you know, never really knew it was going to happen or not, because it's so tough to get into IndyCar, and it takes so many people and so much funding and sponsors to get there that when it all came together, it was a pretty, surreal moment for me, for my family, who have worked so hard to help me in any way they can, but you know, it was great. It's the 100th running as well, to be a rookie in that race was really neat. I mean, there's just so many people there, and not just on race day, but throughout the whole month, you know, through Gasoline Alley, people everywhere.
Yep.
All the events around town were just filled with energy. Everyone was excited, and I think a lot of that is carried over to this year as well. I think it got a lot of people, you know, excited again about the race. Maybe people that hadn't been in a few years decided to come back out for the 500 for the 100th running, and you know, ticket sales are up again this year, so it's going to be, I think, really good again. And you know, being the starting grid of the 100th running and seeing all those people was amazing. But you know, once the green flag drops, then it all kind of goes out the window, and you've got too much other stuff to worry about and focus on than thinking about the occasion.
So, I mean, what is that ratio of the drivers that aspire to get to IndyCar to the ones that actually succeed there? Any idea how many don't make it to that level?
Most of them. I mean, you know, there's only 33 people in the Indy 500, and there's hundreds of people racing go-karts and racing other car series and that have tried to get here and not done it, or maybe gotten here and done one race and that was it. So it's, I mean, it's kind of hard to put a number on it, but the majority of people, unfortunately, that might be just as talented as guys that are running at the front of IndyCar races, you know, everything has to fall right into place to get there. So it's, you know, for the ones that do make it, we're all very fortunate. And I think a lot of us realize that, you know, we're very lucky and things just kind of went just right for us. But, you know, I always try to give advice and help any young kids that are coming up to try and make it up as well, because I know how hard it is and how much work it takes from not only you, but, you know, it takes a whole team of people, let alone on the race team, to make it happen.
Yeah, we were talking before air just about the reality of there's so many drivers that are incredible drivers, but the money wasn't there to unlock that next level. So sponsorships and the hunt for sponsorships is incredibly challenging as you're going up the ranks, right? And it's tough. You have a unique story yourself. Is that in some scenarios there's a lot of drivers that come from money, mm-hmm. right? And that's a whole other echelon of I shouldn't say echelon, a whole other sector of driving, right? Is that there's not nearly as much of a worry of how it's going to be funded, yep. right? But you're coming from an entire background where that wasn't there. So literally the hunt to be able to get the car taken care of, get the team paid, right, has been ever present every year that you've been doing racing.
Yeah, it has, and that's something that is very unique to motor racing, I think. I mean, there's a lot of guys that are extremely talented, like you said, that have won a lot of races, and if they were in, you know, soccer or college football,
right,
you know, some of the best in the country, they would be, you know, drafted into the NFL or whatever and be a paid professional athlete right from the get-go. And it's not like that in racing. You know, you basically have to pay to do this all the way up until IndyCar, and there's even people paying to do it in IndyCar as well. So that's another aspect that, like you said, is very challenging. And it really is a unique thing that we have here in America. To get up to IndyCar, there's a system called the Mazda Road to Indy, which is the feeder system, like we were talking about, USF 2000, right. Pro Mazda, Indy Lights, and then hopefully into IndyCar. And what Mazda provide is a scholarship to the champion. So if you win USF 2000 championship, you get a scholarship of about $300,000, $400,000 to move up to Pro Mazda.
Oh, cool.
Which pretty much covers the whole ride. Because these teams in the lower levels, for the 1 year, this is what they do to feed their family and to make a living. So they don't have, you know, like Penske, obviously, he's got this massive corporation. And, you know, these guys, this is what they do for a living. So they have to make money and they rely on the drivers to bring that money to go racing. So again, if you win the Pro Mazda championship, you get a scholarship to go into Indy Lights. And if you win Indy Lights, you get some money to go into IndyCar. So that's something very unique to motorsports worldwide. I mean, there's nothing like that in Europe or anywhere. So that's something that I was very fortunate enough to take advantage of and win some scholarships. And I was lucky that it was all going towards IndyCar because that's what, you know, I wanted to do. So it really worked out well for me. But like you said, you know, not everyone can win the championship every year, and I certainly didn't. Mm-hmm. So then you have to go out and find sponsorship or investors or something. You have to be creative sometimes. And the problem is that there's not a whole lot of commercial value for USF 2000,
right?
Because they're not on TV. They're not, you know, they're racing at the big events, but you know, you're racing in the mornings, 9 a.m. No one's there, so it's, you know, it's very difficult. You have to be very lucky a lot of times, and I kind of was able to fund it based off guys that just really loved racing that had been successful in their business life that wanted to help a young American driver. So that was really the key to me progressing and moving on up, but you know, a lot of guys stall out, you know, if they don't win that scholarship.
Yep.
And it can take just a wheel being loose or some $10 screw pulling out. And that can just destroy one race, which can lead to losing the championship. So it's
Everything's hinged on the team, the mechanics.
It is, yep.
All the money getting to that point in time. But it's precarious. It's not just you can rely upon yourself. And your endurance, I mean, in sports, you've got a lot of control over what you can do, but there's so many different variables in the equation.
There are, and, you know, it happens at every level. I mean, you know, 2 weeks ago at the Indy Grand Prix, we were having a great race. You know, we didn't qualify great, started 16th or something, but within the first 20 laps, we had made my way up to 6th and right on the gearbox of 5th, so we're having a great race. We come in for our first pit stops, the guys do a great job, and then we had a little electrical issue that caused the car to stall. So engine stopped, had to pull it back, restart it, lost a ton of time, and you know, was still able to finish ninth, but that's something that could have been a third or a fourth, which is, you know, would have been way better, obviously, and you know, it just didn't happen, and not for anyone's lack of effort or for anyone's lack of talent. It just shit happens, right? Yeah. And, you know, you can't control it.
Yep. And I mean, that's the thing, is that I'm certain that in the culture of racers and the culture of racing, you know, that concept, shit happens, has to be embraced, because you can't flog yourself. You just got to say, all right, learn from it, move on, right?
Exactly. I mean, you just sometimes it's not your day, and you just have to know that you did your best. And, you know, I know that I could have finished in the top five, which is nice, but it's also a little more frustrating.
Yeah.
You know, even, you know, a ninth isn't too bad, but at least we finished ninth knowing we could have been higher up. It's not like we finished ninth by a lucky pit stop or a strategy or something. So,
you know, you're killing it.
It's So you can either look at it as that's a positive, or, man, that's even more frustrating. but we've got a lot more races, and I think we're going to have some good finishes, so we'll just keep plugging away.
Well, speaking to the sponsors that got you through these years, you want to give a shout-out to anybody, any organizations that have been making sure that you have what you need to be successful?
Yeah, well, there's an awful lot, but, you know, recently, and maybe something more Indianapolis specific, is Rising Star Racing, who Art Wilmus is a local businessman here downtown Indy, and you know, he's always been a race fan. He's been to the 500 for years and years, and just recently decided that he wanted to get more involved in racing and help out some young American drivers. So I was one of three guys, including Joseph Newgarden and Neil Alberico, is like the original Rising Star Racing class, or whatever you want to call it. And so he was very instrumental in me continuing into IndyCar and doing my first season of IndyCar last year with Eddie Carpenter Racing. So, you know,
the other two racers are also all American, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Joseph's now with Team Penske, and Neil's in Indy Lights. So the goal of this is to help guys that don't have the big family money or you know, an uncle or whatever.
Right.
That are talented to keep moving up the ladder. So it's a very unique system, and you know, obviously very lucky to be a part of it. Cool. And then this year at the Indy 500, we've got Oceanfront Recovery on the car, so just excited to be with them. And you know, a lot of little people, that too many to mention, that have helped me across my career.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, and you know, you can't go through everybody, but at the same time, you know, there's greatness behind you, and a lot of times you can't see the sponsorships that are moving you, but they truly are believing in you, and you're here, because of that group of people. So that's fantastic. So I got to ask you here to wrap up. What does it feel like going 230 miles an hour?
Yeah, I get asked that question a lot, and it's kind of hard to explain. Last year was my first time in an IndyCar around the Speedway, and as a rookie, you have to go through something called ROP, Rookie Orientation Practice, where they basically just make sure you can handle the speeds. You have to do 10 laps between 205 and 210, 10 laps between 210 and 215, and then 10 laps over 215 before they sign off on you that you're allowed to compete in the Indy 500. So, you know, the first segment, 205 to 210, I was like, man, this feels pretty damn fast already. And knowing that that's slow. I mean, if you're going 205, you're going to get black flag basically, because it's unsafe, the closing speeds. So, you know, it's not like going from 25 to 35 miles an hour on the street. Every mile an hour or two at that speed just feels exponentially faster, and you kind of get used to it. But still, you know, every time, when especially when Fast Friday comes around, they bump the horsepower up, and you go into turn one for the first time, and you've got way more shift lights on, you can hear the engine screaming even louder, and you feel that you're going faster, and you have to try and keep it flat through turn one, and it definitely gets your attention. And until you— not everyone obviously can experience it, but it's kind of hard to explain. And at the same time, it it kind of, you kind of get used to it, and then it all becomes kind of relative, and it never really feels super fast until something goes wrong. I mean, once you're going backwards, then it feels really fast.
I've heard it likened to being in the jet plane cockpit. I mean, that type of movement and that type of focus that you have, you can't see. I mean, not that you get tunnel vision, but yeah, I mean, you have a very select number of things that you can even focus on. Everything is just moving so fast that you can only lock in on a few things, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And you have to prioritize what you want to focus on. I mean, there's no room in the cockpit to do much at all. I mean, it's very small. It's, you know, trying to be as efficient as possible through the air. So in that way, it's very similar to an airplane, I would imagine. But at the same time, now you're racing with all these cars, and you have to be looking at them, seeing what they're doing, trying to figure out how to approach the next corner, where to place your car, because it's so reliant, these cars, on airflow over the wings to get grip. That's basically where 90% of our grip comes from, is from downforce. So if you're falling behind the car in front of you, then all that air, the weight kind of goes above your car, and now you've got no air basically over your
wings.
So
you're
sliding all over the place. So you're constantly trying to stick a wing out here, stick a wing out there, just to get some airflow. And when there's 33 cars on the track and you're mid-pack or, you know, starting where I am, there's really nothing. So
you have no way to break away.
No grip.
Yeah.
It feels, you know, it doesn't feel comfortable at all. I mean, it's fun in a way, but in a lot of ways, it's not really that fun, because you're going so fast and you know that any little mistake is going to not be good.
Right.
Going to end badly. And it's just not a comfortable feeling, because when you're in clean air, you know, like qualifying, even though you're on light downforce,
right,
you feel pretty planted most of the time. But when you have all these cars, all this, we call it dirty air, all the wakes coming off the cars in front, it's not comfortable. It doesn't feel good. It's, you know.
And it's constantly varying, so you really can't count on
it.
Yeah,
exactly. It's different every corner, every lap, and you have to do it for 200 laps. So it's, you know, it's, we're not relaxing out there, that's for sure.
Well, that's an experience. To wrap up, what'd you learn from last year's race in preparation for this year's race?
Kind of what I was just talking about, you know, running in that dirty air, there's a lot of, you know, kind of tricks you can do to try and find a little bit more grip. So, you know, last year all that was new to me, so I came in, you know, trying to figure a lot of that out. So this year I come back and I kind of have a head start on where I was, and definitely feel a lot more comfortable in that dirty air and in traffic. And, you know, already this year in practice, we've been, you know, passing a lot more cars than I did last year, and just been a lot racier. So, you know, just having that other level, next level of comfort in a very uncomfortable situation is going to be important, I think.
Oh, fantastic. So the team's going to be ready for Sunday?
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know, we're on track again today, this afternoon, and, then we have a few days off, so it's going to be nice for them to get some rest and really focus on preparing the car. And they need some rest. They've been working really hard.
So what do you work on for Monday and Tuesday, like the first part of the week? What do you focus on?
So now it's all race running, you know, running in that traffic, running behind cars, because that's what the race is like, as you know, for 200 laps. So we'll go out and we'll try and find a lot of other cars to run with and make some changes here and there, trying to make it a little bit better, a little bit more comfortable. And, you know, practice pit stops and do all that stuff so the guys can get warmed up, because in the race, I think there's 7 or 8 pit stops,
right,
and they can be extremely important to the outcome. So get them warmed up on that, and then they'll just double check everything, you know, check all the nuts and bolts, make sure everything's nice and clean and shiny for all the pictures on Sunday.
So which is it more? Is it more physically draining or mentally draining when you're racing that?
At this specific track, it's definitely more mental. The thing that makes IndyCar racing very physical is that there's no power steering, and what makes the steering heavy is the downforce. So a track like this, where you're really focusing on straight line speed a lot of times, you have very little downforce. You know, we might have 2,000 pounds of downforce here at Indy, but on a road and street course, we'll have almost 6,000 pounds of downforce pushing down on the car. So that's what really makes the steering weight heavy. And, you know, our next race is in Detroit, which is the bumpiest place I've ever been to. So you're bumping around, you're moving around, and it's heavy. So stuff like that is really physical. But, you know, this is a very long race, so it does get a little tiring towards the end, and and you can kind of cramp up because you're basically flat for most of the time, so your leg gets tired. And but physically, it's not one of the harder races, but it's very mentally draining.
Speaking of pressure, right? We saw that you threw the first pitch at a Reds game recently. So what's more nerve-wracking? Is it the race or throw the pitch at a Reds game?
They're pretty similar, actually. Yeah, it was cool, though. Yeah, I was supposed to actually throw the first pitch at a Cubs game last year, but it got rained out.
Oh,
so this
man.
Is my... I know, it would have been right. Really neat. We got up there. I got the jersey, got the ball, was on the field, and then 10 minutes before I was supposed to throw it, it started downpouring. So this year I got to go over to Cincinnati and throw a pitch, and it was definitely, you know, I didn't warm up. I hadn't thrown a baseball in ages. It was a little high, but
at least I got it there,
and it was somewhat accurate. But yeah, definitely when I was like, oh, it's going to be no problem. And then when you get up to the mound and it's a little further away than you think, and there's a lot of people watching you, so you definitely get a few butterflies.
Absolutely. All right, so last question here. When you're not in an Indy car, what car or cars do you drive?
Well, I drive a Chevy Tahoe. I don't actually own a car. It's a company car that they let us drive around in, so I actually don't even own a car. But yeah, I've had a couple cars in the past. I had a Mazda. It was my first car, a Mazda Speed 3, then a 3 Series BMW, and now just driving a Tahoe.
Does it really irritate you when you're in traffic?
Sometimes.
And some idiot drivers that are in front of you?
I really get annoyed with slow people in the left lane, which I'm sure everyone does.
Yeah.
You know, people even, not
but
using
even
their
more
blinker.
So, right?
Yeah, it's actually not a bad thing if they slow me down, because I've gotten too many tickets already.
Yeah.
So, you know, even though I get annoyed, sometimes like, all right, well, at least I won't get a ticket.
Yeah. It's like a natural restriction.
It is, yeah.
Well, fantastic, Spencer. We want to make sure that everybody knows where to find you on Twitter. Spencer at Spencer Pigott, P-I-G-O-T. Facebook is Spencer-Pigott. Oh, we got a long list of numbers there. We got to fix that for you. Instagram at Spencer Pigott and website SpencerPigott.com. Any final words for people that maybe, boys and girls that are aspiring to go into racing? Any thoughts about how to do it, and just some inspiration there?
Yeah, well, specifically here in Indianapolis, there's a great go-kart track about 30 minutes, I guess it's east, out in Newcastle, Indiana, mm-hmm. which I've raced at since I was 10, 11 years old as well. It's a great place to go out and learn. There's a lot of really good people there. So if anyone out there interested in racing, I'd suggest, you know, going out there. They've got lots of go-karts you can rent, you know, for all ages. And, you know, also if you want a taste of karting, there's a lot of indoor karting places here in Indy on the north side, Fast Times, and Sarah Fisher has got a new place over in Speedway. So I just encourage people to go out and try it. You know, obviously it's a sport that I love, and, you know, it's a little addicting. So, you know, if you do enjoy it, then, you know, just try your best and keep plugging away, because it's very difficult. It could get a little discouraging at times, but, you know, I think that the people that really are determined and continue to work hard at it will definitely get their chances.
It's very gratifying, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. Yeah.
Very cool. Well, thank you so much for your time, and wish you all the luck in the world on Sunday.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me, and hope to see some of the listeners out there.
Absolutely. All right, well, just to wrap up, thank you to our special guests, Michael Pearson of Daredevil Brewing, fantastic interview, as well as Spencer Pigott. Be sure to go out, you know, build local, shop local, and go to the baseball games, right? And connect with the fabric.
And the race,
absolutely. Everything that's happening in Indy. I mean, this month alone is incredible for all the different activities inside of Indianapolis. So check it out and support our city. That's a wrap for this Edge of Indy. Thanks so much, and we'll see you at the race. Bye-bye.